more of the network support for Bitcoin mining.
All right, that's the CEO. This is what a resident of that state actually thinks about crypto mining.
And they bring business and jobs for us. That's what I like about it. I'm not really into the currency, coins, and stuff like that yet, though. I don't know much about all that, but I know that I got a lot of people that got a lot of work out there. A lot of friends of mine and clients of mine that work out there.
Can you believe that? I mean, a state and not the only one in the U.S. that is allowing crypto mining on a large scale, and that's right under the nose of the U.S. government, because in essence what it's doing is taking away the power of the U.S. dollar, and the government is just sitting idly by. At least that's what it appears. Well, joining us for a rundown of this is Mark Thornton. He's a senior fellow at Ludwig von Mises Institute. Okay, welcome, Mark. So we're looking at cryptocurrencies. We're looking at digital currencies. The U.S. government has been increasingly taking steps one way or another to try to undermine cryptocurrency transactions and importing the widespread financial surveillance of the banking system to cryptocurrencies. What a threat do you think those cryptocurrencies pose for the U.S.?
Well, they're not infringing on cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency users just because they want to suppress their privacy. They're after their money. And so they're using regulation and brute force in order to collect more tax revenue and to discourage the use of cryptocurrency. They would prefer everybody in the United States and around the world be forced to use the U.S. dollar. And so they're worried about people fleeing to cryptocurrencies as a hedge against the U.S. dollar and against inflation. You know, whereas the U.S. dollar is falling in value, cryptocurrency is on a long-run trend. Right now, it's down significantly in the short run, but the long-run trend is up. So it's not really for your paycheck and what you buy on a weekly basis at the store, but for people with a lot of money, business people, entrepreneurs, bankers, and so forth, those people are really concerned about their currency and their cash in the long run. So the U.S. is trying to take a cut in terms of taxation, and they're trying to suppress cryptocurrencies in order to help prop up the U.S. dollar.
Okay, that's what our guest there, Mark Thornton, thinks. Let's bring in author of The Money Masters, Bill Still, to get his thoughts on that. Bill Still, welcome to Economic Divide. Our guest, Mark Thornton, thinks that in the long run, cryptocurrencies are going to be domineering, to say the least. But we're looking at the U.S. government taking increasingly steps to try to undermine the anonymity of cryptocurrency transactions. Do you think that the cryptocurrency actually poses a threat to the U.S.? Is that the way that the U.S. thinks about it?
Well, it puts at risk the debt money system that the international bankers have imposed on the United States since 1913. In other words, right now, Joe Biden is spending a lot of money, like $2 or $3 trillion, into the U.S. economy. But he's not just spending money. He's borrowing money to spend money. And the borrowing part adds extra interest. And this extra interest could amount to nearly $1 trillion per year of additional interest. And so, but that's just absolutely not necessary. They could do it without adding the interest. But of course, this is the debt money system that has made them very wealthy and powerful, and so they're not about to do that. And cryptocurrency, which operates with a very small cost, would threaten that system directly.
So I know that the combination has caused some confusion out there. So to make it clear, is not the same as cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is decentralized and permissionless, meaning nobody controls it and everybody have access to it. While the central bank digital currency, like the digital yuan in this regard, is centralized and controlled by the PBOC.
Nigeria is the latest country to launch a CBDC.
This payment system now provides high value and time critical payment services to financial institutions and ultimately serves as the backbone for every electronic payment in Nigeria.
Of the countries with the four largest central banks, namely the US, the Euro area, Japan and the UK, the United States is the furthest behind.
And that fear of the unknown and the move to regulate before understanding will only stifle American ingenuity and put us at a competitive disadvantage.
And that could threaten the status of the dollar.
If the federal government instead stifles the adoption of digital assets, issuers, talent, and capital will flee for more welcoming jurisdictions. That would be a disaster for Americans, both consumers and workers, and our economy as a whole.
The U.S. is trying hard to cope with the rise of cryptocurrencies and digital currencies, or CBDC, and it is afraid that it would lose leverage in one key area: foreign policy and the use of sanctions. The U.S. has actually made it public through its Treasury Department, warning that digital currencies could weaken U.S. sanctions. The report said technological innovations such as digital currencies, alternative payment platforms, and new ways of hiding cross-border transactions all potentially reduce the efficacy of American sanctions. These technologies offer malign actors opportunities to hold and transfer funds outside the traditional dollar-based financial system. But the U.S. has been worried about the decline of the dollar since it has overused its sanctions regime against countries it sees as adversaries like China, Russia, Venezuela, and Iran. These countries have all taken steps to not only reduce their reliance on the U.S. dollar, but also eliminate it in some cases when it comes to bilateral trade. They have accused the U.S. of using sanctions as a political tool. The new digital payment system could erode the power of American sanctions as this trend continues. Another financial instrument that could prove futile would be SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication. It serves as an intermediary and executor of financial transactions between banks worldwide. Because of cryptocurrencies and CBDCs, countries will have a much easier time transacting with each other directly. This would remove the need for the US dollar or SWIFT. It will also remove the oversight by this organization or the requirement for its member countries to hand over their financial transactions. Already, China and Russia are moving to eliminate the U.S. dominance of global financial system. The leaders of the two countries have agreed on plans to establish a new shared international financial framework. Okay, that does it for this section of the program. Please let us know what you think about digital currencies. Are you for them or against them? It's important that we hear from you. And from me, Mahdi, it's goodbye until next time.
It is pretty clear that the world of money is moving towards digital currencies. Governments around the world will need to jump on board, or literally they could sink. Well, the U.S. has been late in going digital. That it's going to adopt a digital currency, the notion is still on the table. I mean, after all, this could potentially mean losing control and losing profits. What does that mean? It means that banks are going to be affected. It would eat away from the bottom line. But is it too late for the U.S.? Will the onslaught of countries introducing digital currencies downgrade or decrease the value of the dollar, where it can no longer be used as, let's say, a foreign policy tool, i.e. sanctions? That could happen sooner than later. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. Until the next episode, it's goodbye from me, Kavit Atley, and the entire team.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. And this is the sender's address. This is the receiver's address, who is my cousin's address. And this is the subject of the email. And now the enter's key. Finished. Oh, well, we're living in the era of speed and technology, and in my idea, it's a really good era. Typing and sending this email just took 5 minutes, and my cousin, who lives in Germany, received my message in seconds. If it was 50 years ago, she must have waited for weeks to receive my message. Today, we are going to visit Tehran's Post and Communications Museum. Stay with me. Iranians of Achaemenid era, by establishing Chaparkhane, literally courier house, opened the first postal service in the world. Greek historian Herodotus writes about the postal system in Iran. There is nothing that travels faster and yet is mortal than these couriers. The Persians invented this system, which works as follows. It is said that there are as many horses and men posted at intervals as there are days required for the entire journey, so that one horse and one man are assigned to each day. And neither snow nor rain nor heat nor dark of night keeps them from completing their appointed course as swiftly as possible. Initially, Tehran's Post and Communications Museum was opened in 1932 as part of the Ministry of Post and Telegraph. This building, which was located at southern part of Imam Khomeini Square, was dismantled in 1970. The current building of the museum was constructed, inspired by the national architecture, and is one of the outstanding structures of the area of Tehran's National Garden. I am now standing beside the building of Tehran's Post and Communications Museum. This building once used to be called the post office. Several different materials have been used in this big, beautiful building. Stone, brick, and wood. It has also a gable roof. Let's go inside to see what's going on there. Tehran's Post and Communications Museum is a two-story building along with a basement. There are 8 chambers in each floor which have been allocated for a certain subject. I am now on the first floor of the museum. This chamber is ceremonial and for the ministerial level. Photos of 72 ministers since past till now have been showcased in this chamber. And this chamber consists of postal staff. Different post boxes from Iran and other countries are here. It's very interesting. And here, there are the uniforms of postmen. And in this part of the chamber, you can see seals by which postage stamps were revoked. And I am now in the chamber of Silk Road. Here, all the communications stuff of the past time till today have been showcased. On my right, there is a chariot with a horse. And in this part of the chamber, there is a small vehicle with 3 wheels, which has this writing, post. And on the other side, you can see a replica of an airplane. However, these days, drones are used for sending mails. I am now on the second floor. Here there is a big hall called the Hall of International Stamps. Here there are stamps from 130 countries. Oh, look at the showcases. Inside the showcases, you can see sealed envelopes, which have been donated to this museum by well-known or outstanding figures. Ah, good old days. My father gave me a stamp album when I was 8. I take a look at my grandma's basement this time. Maybe I can't find my album there. Perhaps my stamp album has become precious during these years, and I can donate it to the museum. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian Foreign Minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's Foreign Minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe. But it is within the European continent, and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached.
European Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Iran and the five remaining parties to the JCPOA resumed talks in Vienna on November 29, after a five-month hiatus, marking the first round of negotiations under President Ebrahim Raisi's administration, and the seventh overall. During the seventh round of the Vienna talks, Iran presented two draft texts which addressed separately the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group of countries resumed the talks at the Austrian capital on December 9, when the participants returned to their capitals for additional consultations on the two draft proposals that Tehran had put forward. Since the U.S. administration under Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, the EU refused to play a constructive role to revive the deal. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, but the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no options but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal.
Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has said that European companies can end contracts with Iranian firms pressured by U.S. sanctions if upholding the deals would lead to disproportionate economic loss. The judgment from the court in Luxembourg was prompted by a lawsuit from the German branch of Iran's state-owned bank Meli against Deutsche Telekom after the telecommunications provider terminated a contract with the bank in 2018 prior to its expiry.
The position of the European court, it's an indication that Iran cannot trust to sign any future deal with any European company, because although the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg accepted the lawsuit forwarded by the German branch of Iran Bank Meli against the Deutsche Telekom, however, the decision of the European bank is shameful.
The situation in the Israeli-occupied West Bank has become highly volatile. Israeli settlers have stepped up their attacks against Palestinian communities across the occupied territory. And Israeli forces have been using lethal force against the Palestinians more than often. Palestinian men, women, and even children have been losing their lives to Israeli gunfire. 2021 has been the deadliest year for Palestinian children since 2014. Increasingly frustrated with unending Israeli occupation, ongoing land grab, deadly violence, and lack of international action, some Palestinians have tried to take matters into their own hands by staging car ramming and stabbings against Israelis as some form of resistance against the regime. But the number of fatalities on the two sides is not comparable at all, as Israeli forces use disproportionate force against any form of protest or resistance against the regime. For years, human rights groups have accused Israel of following a shoot-to-kill policy. But things are apparently getting worse these days after the regime recently revised its open-fire policies. Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank are now allowed to open fire on Palestinians who throw rocks or Molotov cocktails even when they don't pose an immediate threat.
I think what the regime is trying to achieve here can be expressed in two words. Dead Palestinians is what it's trying to achieve. One of the major objectives of Zionism is to clear Palestine of all Palestinians and have only Zionist Jews there.
The new open fire policy blatantly violates international law and has drawn widespread condemnation. Palestinians held a funeral on Thursday for a young man who was killed by Israeli gunfire. The mourning procession was held in the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammad Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Such deadly shootings of Palestinians seem to be on the rise in the West Bank. On Tuesday, a Palestinian motorist was gunned down in the northern occupied West Bank after what the Israeli military said was an attempted car ramming of soldiers at a checkpoint. Israel seems determined to keep up its use of deadly force against the Palestinians even when there is no immediate threat. Earlier in December, the United Nations Human Rights Office said it was, quote, shocked by the apparent extrajudicial execution of a Palestinian man who had injured an Israeli with a knife, but was shot and lying on the ground. Israeli forces continued to shoot the man from point blank, even when he was posing no threat. Such shootings are undoubtedly extrajudicial field executions that violate international law. Will Israel's illegal and hard-handed tactics force the Palestinians into submission? Probably not, as Palestinian resistance groups are calling for intensified acts of retaliation against Israel across Palestinian territories. The leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad recently stressed the need for continued resistance operations in the West Bank, saying that the Zionist regime's aggression in the region would have serious consequences and that Tel Aviv would pay a heavy price for its aggressions.
The more oppression they bring upon Palestinians, the more resistance they're going to get. And in fact, this has been true historically for any people that are under oppression. When you're under oppression, you're going to resist, and there will be people who are willing to pay any price to resist.
The occupied West Bank could experience more tensions and deadly violence against the Palestinians in the coming weeks, as the Israeli regime refuses to change its dangerous course.
The United States has stepped up its anti-Iran rhetoric, threatening Iran with, quote, other options if negotiations in the Austrian capital fail to restore the 2015 agreement. The threatening language was made by the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley. He warned of a period of escalating crisis if diplomacy failed to restore the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The remarks came days after negotiators from Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA concluded the seventh round of talks in Vienna, aimed at bringing the U.S. back into compliance with the agreement by removing its sanctions against Iran. Malley referred to Iran's retaliatory measures within the JCPOA framework and said, if they continue at their current pace, we have some weeks left to restore the 2015 deal, but not much more than that, at which point the conclusion will be that there is no deal to be revived. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the window is rapidly closing to save the 2015 agreement and that Washington is exploring other options.
U.S. government is very much aware of this fact that the U.S. Army, the broad masses of Americans, don't want another war. We have just gotten out of Afghanistan after 20 years. Finally, things are perhaps coming to a close in Iraq as well, and so to, you know, within under a year, go back into Eurasia, go back into also the Arab world, and start another war would be absolutely disastrous.
Blinken claimed Iran's nuclear advances are making it increasingly problematic to return to the 2015 agreement. It is getting very, very, very short. Being able to recover the full benefits of the JCPOA by returning to compliance with it is getting increasingly problematic by the advances that Iran makes every single day in its nuclear program. This is while the Vienna talks have taken a break after Iran and the IAEA reached an agreement for the agency to install its cameras at the Karaj nuclear facility, a point insisted by the parties to the talk. Iran also agreed to this as a goodwill gesture. Antony Blinken also blamed the former administration of Donald Trump for the worst decision made in American foreign policy in the last decade by withdrawing from the deal in 2018. The threatening language against Iran comes amid ongoing talks to revive the deal, which was abandoned by the United States in 2018 under the administration of the former President Donald Trump. Israel has opposed efforts to revive the 2015 deal, which lifted sanctions on Tehran in exchange for curbs on its nuclear program, and has continued to threaten direct military action against Iranian nuclear facilities.
We've seen historically with U.S. presidents, U.S. administrations, that when approval ratings are very, very low, it's common for a president to start a war and attempt to secure a second term. And so Biden, who is experiencing record low approval ratings, may be seeing that as his only option for re-election.
There are some reports that Israel may be preparing for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, but former Israeli officials have admitted that Tel Aviv regime is not capable of taking out Iran's nuclear program. Israeli military officials have also cast doubt on the Israeli military's capabilities to destroy all of Iran's nuclear facilities.
So if Israel wanted to take on Iran, because Israel most certainly couldn't do it on its own for a variety of reasons, I think the most significant being Iran would, you know, for lack of better terminology, Iran would wipe the floor with Israel and with the IDF. They would need U.S. support. And Israel can basically yank the chain of the U.S. government and the international media apparatuses and say, you know, we want war, we want the propaganda coming out, and the U.S. and the U.S. media, the global media, and the global financial institutions are going to do whatever Israel says.
Iran has warned Israel against any wrong move. The top IRGC official has said any aggression by Israel against Iran would not be possible without the U.S. giving its approval. If such threats are implemented, the Islamic Republic's armed forces will mount thrashing attacks against all centers, bases, paths, and spaces used to enable the violation and against the origins of the violation. Iran has held massive drills in the southern provinces to increase its preparation for any scenario. In the exercises, the IRGC forces showcase their latest capabilities and military hardware, including an advanced homegrown tank dubbed Karar.
London Breed, mayor of San Francisco, has declared a state of emergency in the drug-infested neighborhood of Tenderloin to clean up what she called its nasty streets. The district has long been known for the number of homeless people, drug users, and drug dealers on the streets. Breed believes this state of emergency would disrupt the illegal activity in the neighborhood and get people the treatment and support they need. London Breed's announcement broke with the liberal tradition and exposed the extent of the crisis plaguing the city's streets. But San Francisco isn't the only city reeling from violence and drugs. More than 100,000 Americans died this year from drug overdoses. The situation has become so dire that U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order last week to fight organized crime networks whose actions are impacting the country's public health.
The overreach of the government dictates what families can do when it comes down to disciplining their children and all of that. So now you see generations having passed without any type of structure. The family is decaying. And of course, this is something that is touted on the news wave, media, all of those different things. It's a consistent thing where families are being denigrated.
In the meantime, cities across the U.S. are setting their all-time high records for homicides, most of which involving firearms. The Texas city of Austin, for example, where gun control is lax, has reported 88 homicides in 2021, eclipsing the previous high of 59 that was reported in 1984. Austin is among the 9 cities that have broken their homicide records. The case in point is that they are not concentrated, but are all scattered around the U.S. map. Stores across the U.S. have increasingly been coming under raids by mobs who have been collecting tens of thousands of dollars worth of cash and goods in recent weeks. Although most of the ransacked high-end stores are located in the U.S. state of California, similar incidents have been taking place elsewhere in the country too. Police statistics show that theft and larceny have been up about 88% compared to last year, with the overall crime rate standing at almost 52% higher in 2021. A recent study suggests that the crime rate in the underprivileged areas has jumped much higher compared to wealthier districts in the first 5 months of the coronavirus pandemic. Law enforcement officials reject the idea that the rise in the so-called smash-and-grab attacks has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, they believe the police's permissive attitude toward theft and the holiday season have been the factors pushing the numbers.
And of course, this lawlessness is a result of things that are unjust, things that continue to happen, and righteous judgment is not being implemented or instituted. And so also to add to that, it's a departing of the morality, the values and everything that this country was supposed to have espoused 2 years ago has been changed.
Some also believe law enforcement's lack of resources has forced the police to deprioritize theft, while others blame a lack of political will to fight such offenses. All indications are suggesting that the current crime rates in the U.S. are likely to become a new normal.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on October 16, 2021 in a meeting with the officials in charge of the martyrs of Zanjan commemoration ceremony. The commemoration ceremony was held on October 28, 2021. The need to study the funeral ceremonies held for martyrs.
You can also address martyrs' funeral ceremonies. One of the subjects that has been neglected, not been paid attention to so far, and should receive more attention, is the funeral ceremonies of the martyrs during the war and at the present time. At the present time too, when they bring the bones of a martyr into a city, a magnificent funeral ceremony is held. Every few days during the war, in different cities, in Zanjan and elsewhere, huge funerals were held. Poets would compose poems and elegies, and people would beat their chests in memory of martyrs. This is unprecedented in the whole world. These are astonishing, memorable events that should be recorded and preserved.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد
The world of Islam has one single prescription today and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. Naming streets and roads after martyrs.
Another issue is the naming of streets and roads in cities. Cities should be decorated with the names of memories of martyrs. The city councils in different cities should know the names of the people the city is proud of. What honor is higher for a city, for a street, for a road and an alley than that the name of a great martyr, the name of a man of sacrifice, be put on it? These are things to follow up on. You should follow up on these issues. You have taken the first step, which is the accomplishment of these tasks and the formation of such commemoration ceremonies, and you should continue following up on these matters. God the Exalted will bestow the blessings brought by martyrs on our nation, God willing. May He raise their pure souls with that of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. God willing, they will soon see the results of their endeavors, which is the victory of the Iranian nation. Fortunately, the Iranian nation has always moved forward towards victory over these years. God willing, the economic problems will be resolved as well. The problems that exist today in livelihood, the economic situation and such things will be eliminated, God willing, with the determination of the officials and the endeavors of people such as you. May God reward you with His grace and raise our magnanimous Imam who showed us this path with the Holy Prophet. May the pure souls of the martyrs be satisfied with us. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. Congress passed a $778 billion war and military budget, about half of which will go to corporate contractors, they failed to pass the Build Back Better plan that costs less than a quarter of that annually and would have delivered help to millions of people. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Lindsay Kashagarian journalist. This article is titled, "A $778 Billion Pentagon Budget is American People's Lump of Coal." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. What if you wanted less child poverty, better health care, more help with child care and elder care, and at least a gesture toward a solution to the climate crisis? And what if instead you got a $778 billion check for war profiteering? That's the bait and switch Americans just got, as U.S. Congress passed a $778 billion war and military budget, about half of which will go to corporate contractors, and failed to pass the Build Back Better plan that costs less than a quarter of that annually and would have delivered help to millions of people. Despite the slash-and-burn approach taken by the U.S. Congress to the plan, each and every major provision of Build Back Better is supported by a majority of voters. This is, in fact, not what Americans want. A large majority of voters support the Build Back Better plan, which would continue to send checks to families with children, expand health care subsidies, make child care and home care more affordable, and invest in clean energy. Despite the slash-and-burn approach taken by Congress to the plan, each and every major provision of Build Back Better is supported by a majority of voters. And a majority would like to see the Pentagon budget cut by 10% to fund domestic needs, the exact things that Build Back Better funds. Much has been made of Senator Joe Manchin's declared opposition to the Build Back Better plan. But after months of negotiations for help that people desperately need, progressives are not ready to give up that easily. It's not over. In case you need some motivation to get involved, here are the facts about what U.S. Congress is choosing when it funds a $778 billion Pentagon budget over Build Back Better. More for Pentagon contracts to a single company, including Lockheed Martin, $75 billion in FY 2021. Then childcare and preschool, that is $40 billion per year under BBBA. More for equipment and programs the Pentagon didn't even ask for, $25 billion. Then child and earned income tax credit, $20 billion per year under BBBA. More on guarding the world's oil supply, $81 billion a year. Then for climate and clean energy initiatives to protect the planet, $55 billion a year under BBBA. And more for the Space Force, $17.5 billion. Then for healthcare for Americans, $13 billion a year under BBBA. More than twice as much for military bases in Germany, $7.5 billion. Then for Medicare hearing benefits, $3.5 billion a year under BBBA. And more for the wasteful F-35, $12 billion then on a better immigration system, $10 billion a year under BBBA. These are the wrong priorities, and it's up to movements and grassroots pressure to turn this around.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
It was supposed to ensure seamless trade between the UK and the EU following Brexit. But the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a problem itself. Or has it? Negotiated in 2019, the protocol was aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, still in the EU's single market, and EU member Republic of Ireland. Instead, it's created a regulatory border in the Irish Sea, which acts as a de facto EU-UK frontier. Now, British goods entering Northern Ireland are subject to EU checks and customs regulations. While some have disliked the protocol from day one, others have found it beneficial.
From a business perspective, the Brexit and backstance and the protocol has been a good thing for the people of the North of Ireland. Obviously, we have the best of both worlds. But if you listen to a small minority that is being platformed by the media, both in Britain and the North of Ireland here, you would think that the protocol was damaging business.
That small minority are elements in the loyalist or unionist community in Northern Ireland, people who wish their country to remain part of the UK. They feel they have been cut off from the mainland. Before becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson had told pro-UK parties that he didn't want to see Northern Ireland left abandoned by a border in the sea.
Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
That assurance fell by the wayside. A sense of betrayal prevailed. Protests ensued. To the UK government, that meant changing the goalposts.
The protocol is not working. It's completely lost consent in one community in Northern Ireland. It's not doing the thing it was set up to do, protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. In fact, doing the opposite.
A fact only admitted after the UK left the EU. The European Union rejected any renegotiation of the deal. Some experts believe the government must have known about the problems ahead from day one of Brexit, calling into question the UK's credibility as an international trading partner.
The UK has absolutely no credibility internationally. We've seen that. Its two biggest partners in the world, the EU and the American government, have made statements on how they feel about the UK renegotiating international treaties. So even to make any kind of statement with that the UK have any integrity on the international stage now is laughable. UK have no credibility since the Tory government and Brexit.
Another bone of contention, the UK government's demand to remove the EU's legal oversight role, part of the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying as long as the role of the European Court of Justice continues, the protocol will never survive. But in early December, Prime Minister Johnson's Conservative government reluctantly dropped that demand, at a time when it would appear the majority of people in Northern Ireland want an end to the standoff.
Whether they be Irish Unionists or Irish Nationalists, of course, the Tories have always used unionist for the old divide and conquer strategy here in the North of Ireland. So I think it's just sheer incompetence and, of course, the arrogance in it.
Things took a turn for the worse for the UK Prime Minister with the December 18 high-profile resignation of his chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, who was replaced less than 24 hours later by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who openly backed remaining in the EU in 2016. She's now tasked with resolving